listening to National Rock Review.
This is Mick with National Rock Review. I'm on the phone with Pete Midgard of the Twisting Tarantulas tonight, talking to me from Canton, Ohio. How you doing, Pete?
Not bad. I live in Canton, Ohio. I'm from Detroit, though.
Yes, you are a Detroiter at heart, that's for sure.
It's an important distinction to me.
Yes, sir.
I moved to Canton, Ohio. My wife did.
Right on.
She's the one with the good job, so.
Very cool.
Where she goes, I'm sure. Well, and of course, I love her, too, but, you know.
Well, that kind of helps as well, too, right?
It does help. Yeah. It does help, especially when she says we're moving to Ohio.
Well, a man's not complete till he's married, then he's finished. So, hey, you guys are getting ready to jam up in Toledo, Ohio tonight on the most infamous bar night of the year at the Dirty Bird in Toledo, Ohio. You guys are celebrating
downtown Toledo.
You guys got 21 years in existence this year. And then we're going to see you at the Tip Top Deluxe in Grand Rapids, Michigan on Friday. And then at the Rock in Plymouth, Michigan on Saturday with the Blues Airmen. So, what do you attest to the longevity of your band and the following that you have?
I think it's just being adaptable as I possibly can be without, you know, compromising what the core of the band is. You know, I mean, we started out probably much more of a more traditional rockabilly and, you know, blues type band, swing band. It's always been a trio. And, you know, over the years, things shifted. You know, at first it was more rockabilly, and then the swing thing was real big, so we added more of that to the set. It was just a matter of flexibility, you know. And then, but if we're on a bill with a bunch of rock bands, we can play, you know, loud and fast all for a whole set, like a loud, fast rock band. So, I think more than anything, it's just been, you know, some flexibility without, like I said, without compromising what we are, you know. Play quiet if we have to, which helps, you know, keep gigs on the calendar in between the bigger rock clubs and stuff. I can play a restaurant, I can play a casino, you know, and keeping that money rolling in is probably, you know, one of the keys. And in order to keep the money rolling in and stay booked, you have to be somewhat flexible in what you're doing.
Absolutely.
So, does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Especially in this day and age when the music industry is so constantly changing, putting more power back in the band's hands and there's less money to go around from record labels. And you guys have never even really signed with the label, have you? You guys have been independent this entire time.
Yeah, the first record was, I did it myself. We did it ourselves, the original lineup, and you know, I shopped for a label, and there was only really a couple labels out there that I knew were gonna know how to market us, because, you know, it's a band that's not a real typical style, and a fairly small but very dedicated market, the rockabilly and jump blues scene nationally. So I shopped those two labels. I don't even remember what the second one was. The first one was High Tone, and then there was a second label. I think it was Hepcat. No, it was Yep Rock or something. And there were two labels that were, you know, marketing. They had bands signed like the Paladins and Big Sandy and the Fly Right Boys, Dave Alvin from the Blasters, the Knitters with Xene from X was in on that label. So, and, you know, I sent it to the guy. I thought they was going to knock him out. You know, I was just like, oh, wait till they hear this, you know. And then I call the guy. I don't hear from him for a couple of weeks. And I call him. I'm like, so, yeah, it's Pete from the Tarantulas. What you think? He's like, didn't nothing knock me out about it. That was it. Dead silence. And, you know, I thought we had a good record on our hands. Well, in hindsight, maybe he should have listened a little bit harder, because, you know, since then I've sold, I don't know, 24,000 of those. And, you know, probably a lot more records than a lot of bands that were on his small boutique label at the time. in and out around Detroit and doing a little bit of regional touring. So I got them into the stores and locally in the stores just on consignment. The next thing I know, 3 or 4 days later, all these stores are calling me. Yeah, we're out already. Send, bring us more, but bring us 15 instead of 5 this time. And that went on for months, you know. The only thing that sucked was I kept running out. I kept expecting it to fizzle out and stop selling, and it didn't. But, I mean, the first 3,000 sold in the first, you know, 4 or 5 months, and I wasn't ready for it. You know, I was stunned. I was just really surprised because no one was selling CDs like that at the time. So then labels did start calling because, you know, they're barcoded, and a sound scan shows them that they're selling. And the labels start going, who are these guys? At that point, I'm like making the money myself. You know, I'm making, you know, average $7-$8 profit a disc and selling my at the gigs, and then, you know, the distribution, I'm making at least $5 a record. And, you know, after you sell a couple of thousand at making that much money, it's like, well, why should I hand this money over to this label? I already got distribution. I got everything that they were offering me. So at that point, I just kind of kept going. I never really shopped. You know, there was the second record, maybe Interscope was interested for about 5 minutes. Republic was interested for about 5 minutes. But as soon as I started asking questions, you know, letting them know that I wasn't a dumbass that was just going to piss on the rug because they offered me a record deal, they, you know, the conversation ended pretty quickly. As soon as I started saying, look, I'm not finding a way my publishing and so on and so on. You know, by the time they came looking, I already knew something about record deals, and friends of mine had gotten ripped off, and, you know, I knew the right questions to ask. So,
well, you certainly...
That was a long answer, wasn't it?
That was a great one. It must feel great as a musician for somebody who wants to do this for a living for their life to have found success so early on your own terms.
Yeah, it felt good. I mean, it was a lot of work, and it was frustrating that, you know, I kept underestimating it. And over and over in the first 2 or 3 years, I wasn't prepared for what happened. You know, and then once I finally caught up and got up to speed on things, you know, that 2 or 3 year peak had already happened and it was already leveling off. Then I wasn't in tune with the fact that it was slowing down, and I kept spending money like we were making the same amount when, you know, I wasn't paying attention to the fact that we weren't. You know, especially with record sales, weren't making as much as we had been for a couple of years. So, you know, there's good things and bad things about doing it yourself. You know, the good thing for me now is now I know what I'm doing. You know, at least as far as paying attention to how much money's coming in and going out and knowing what my capability is, how many records I know I can sell right away. And knowing what I don't know how to do and understanding that I gotta have help. You know, when we're working on a new record now, very slowly but surely. This time I know, because the whole computer thing wasn't happening when I first started doing this. I mean, almost not at all. And it's taken off, and I haven't been able to keep up, but I'm 54 years old, you know? So this time around, this record comes out, I know I need help. So I've got to have some help with people, you know, with social media, with and all these uploads and downloads and streaming things and shit. I mean, we're hooked until now with iTunes and CD Baby, and, you know, we got Google Plays, Amazon, Spotify. I think we got Shazam. There's a European one, there's an Asian one. I'm hooked into them all because these, you know, there's companies that, once I got on iTunes, all these companies come out of the woodwork and say, well, now that you're in a digital library, you know, how about being in ours too? And how about being in ours? And it's like for $7 a year, $6 a year, you start joining up with all these different ones. But now it's hard to keep track of it, you know. I have two different administrators, TuneCourse one and CD Davis the other. Between the two, I'm in like 19 or 28 or something different, you know, stores or formats or whatever they call them now. You know, no one's buying songs anymore, you know, as of a couple of years ago. It's all gone to Spotify and Pandora and shit like that. And, you know, people want to hear one of my songs, they just stream it or whatever they call it. Well, see, I don't understand all that well. All I know is my most recent title is 10 years old now, and I'm still making money off of it sitting at home, you know, checking my computer every couple of weeks, and money's coming in just from this digital world. So when this new record comes out, that's what I mean by I need help. I need someone, some type of manager, someone that really understands that world better than I do, because it's a very untapped resource, and the band stands to make, you know, a lot of money, and we need that money. We all do. Everybody does. I'm not going to pretend that I'm doing this just, you know, for the fun of it after 21 years. I got to make money, you know. I didn't have a day job for 17 years with this band. And now I have a day job that I want to quit as soon as the band's making enough money again. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, man, if you do what you love, it's not work, right?
Right.
It's called working the dream.
Once I pick up the bass and start playing, that's what I love. You know, the tough part is all the other hairy bullshit that's involved with it, you know? Getting to the gig through a snowstorm or an ice storm, or, you know, or it's 110 degrees at some wedding in Indiana that we played, or, you know, getting there, getting set up, you know, that's the work. That's what you really get paid for. Standing up there playing and singing, that's 1 hour of fun after about 10 hours of bullshit a lot of times. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, but still, to this day, that 1 hour is still worth it.
There you go. So,
I mean, we're going to Grand Rapids on Black Friday or whatever it's called. You know, couple 2 hour drive, set up, play for, you know, 75 minutes, and tear all that shit back down and drive all the way back home that night.
Now, real quick, before we touch into the new album you have coming out and the new music. When you got online and you started exploring the world of the digital music and the downloads and Napster and all the streaming services, were you surprised by some, you know, like bootleg recordings and stuff you might have found online or live recordings that kind of amazed you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, was I surprised at what I'm able to find? Every time someone sends it to YouTube, like, I'm afraid to open it and watch it because, you know, it's something awesome, but then, you know, you get that screen off to the right, that's what I call the rabbit hole. You know, you go down that YouTube rabbit hole, it's like, you know, like I'm watching a Stanley Clarke video, you know, from the late 70s, and then while I'm watching that, I realize, oh, wow, there's Return to Forever video right there, and then there's, you know, Billy Cobham, George Duke live video, and there's Funkadelic live, you know, all that. Or same thing, you know, someone sends me some video of Kiss playing or you know, a sensational Alex Harvey band or something crazy like that. And next thing you know, I've been sitting in front of the computer for like 3 hours watching, you know, somehow I've managed to go from watching rock bands to what, you know, clips of Batman television shows, and you know what I mean? It's just, it's never ending. I mean, even, you know, for any Detroiters out there, I ended up a couple of months ago, four or five weeks ago, right around Halloween, watching some video of Sir Graves Gaffney, who was the horror show host on Saturday afternoons in Detroit back in the 60s and 70s. And I thought I'd never see, video of that guy ever again. And there I am watching it on YouTube. Someone put it on there. So that blows my mind. You know, that I can watch, I can find footage of Willie Dixon that I never knew existed, and footage of Charles Mingus that I never knew existed, and, you know, footage of Kiss that I never knew existed, just on and on and on and on.
But did you ever find any old Twisting Tarantulas stuff on there that you were like, holy shit, where'd that video come from?
I'm afraid. I've never, YouTubed us. I mean, I have seen it by accident, someone sent me a video of us playing at Autorama or Arch Beach and Eats or something, and then I look off to the right and I'm like, fuck, I don't even want to. Sorry if I'm swearing.
That's all right.
There's video, YouTube stuff of us, playing in Healy, Alaska, like really, really rough video in really bad shape.
So you have a new album, some new material you're working on. Let's talk a little bit about the new CD and how you're producing it, and you have some new members in the band this time around.
All right. Well, the newest member is Nick Morocco, who's played in several other bands around Detroit. He also plays in Blues Arum, and they were on the bill Saturday, this coming Saturday. And he plays with... what are they called? Dark Angel?
Dark Avenger.
Dark Avenger, that's it. I'm always messing with him on that, calling him Duck Dodger and stuff. Just clowning around, but yeah, Nick came in this past summer, and I can't really tell you how many drummers that makes it now. It's been 21 years, and, it's been one every couple of years or so, changing over. Guys do come and go. Guys get burned out. Guys get married. Guys don't want to go on the road anymore. So, especially the first 10 years of the band when we were really, really busy and, doing 180 shows a year. There was a couple of years where we did more than that. You find out that there's a lot of musicians out there that became musicians because they thought it was a way out of working. And then when it becomes work, they don't want to do it. It gets to be too much for them. Like, oh man, we're going out on the road again? No, we just got home 3 weeks ago. But yeah, I told you we were going back out. Get out on the road. I miss home. I'm like, you miss home? You live in the ghetto, dude. And you're married. What do you mean? I was always single going on the road. So, once I finally met someone that I really cared about and got out on the road and missed the shit out of her, I called some of these guys that had been in the band in the past and apologized to them and said, now I finally know how you felt, and I'm sorry that I judged you, because now I'm out on the road, I got someone at home that I care about, and it's a whole different thing. So, I'm glad that I was able to man up and, at least apologize for that.
Certainly. So tell us about the new album that's coming up. You guys are going to start recording after Christmas, right?
Yeah, well, we're supposed to. It's the hardest part. We've been talking about putting a new record out for 2 years, but, I live in another state now, which complicates things, and I'm working a day job. So getting together, for a while we were meeting in Fremont, Ohio, which is halfway to them, halfway for me, at this theater this guy was letting us rehearse at. But even then, it costs money, it costs me $50 in fuel, it costs them $30 in fuel to drive 2 hours each, and then we got to pay the guy at the theater a little bit, use the theater for a few hours. So, every time we rehearse, it was costing me $100, costing the band $100. So it's like, I just have to do it when I come up to Detroit. Well, every time I come up to Detroit, it's to play shows. and we play a couple of nights in a row, and then Sunday afternoon, it's like, oh, I really got to get back to Canton so that I can get ready for work and spend the evening with my wife, whatever. So it's been really difficult since I moved here to get these rehearsals together. And another thing that's slowing me down quite a bit is that, you know, I'm kind of retarded on the computer. So I'm not able to get some, you know, real simple recording software on the laptop, record some songs with a drum machine or whatever, and, you know, turn them into an MP3 and send them to these guys. I'm still, I don't know why. I mean, it's just, I can't blame it all on my age, but that's part of it. You know, I grew up at a time when there was only one computer in our high school, and all it could do was print report cards, and it took up the whole fourth floor, you know. So, I keep saying I need to find someone to teach me how to do this, you know, how to just move audio files around on the laptop and email them to people, compress them, whatever needs to be done, and I could get these songs to them at least so that when we do get together, you know, they already have a pretty good idea what's supposed to be going on with the song. I've got 11 finished, 11 songs done, and then I got like 7 or 8 more that are kind of in a rough stage, you know, where I just get a line, another lyric here and there while I'm driving, and I type it into my phone and jot it down later on the paper. We got just one song that's ready to go on iTunes now. It's mixed and mastered. And that's the Stage Diving Fat Kid song that we've been playing for almost a year now. But that's ready to release. I just got to get the copyright on it and you know, get it registered with my publishing. So that if any, you know, something grand happens to it, I'm not, you know, standing there with my pants down and not able to capitalize, you know what I mean?
Right. So tell us about the origins of that song.
What's that?
Tell us about the origins of that song.
Oh, Stage Diving Fat Kid. I don't remember what made me remember this guy. But, you know, back in the 80s around Detroit, I used to play in a lot of different punk bands. I played in band called The Scraps, I played with Almighty Lumberjack the Dead, and I played with Heresy. So, and we played on a lot of bills with, you know, a lot of Nationals and, you know, like GBH and The Exploited. We played the Circle Jerk several times. I've been on bills with, oh God, I could go down the line, Butthole Surfers, the Ramones, Black Flag. We were always the proverbial opening band. One of the bands that I was in would be opening. We opened for Social Distortion a few times. And then we did a lot of all ages shows of our own, at, you know, either at Greystone or at Trax or where's another venue? St. Andrews, of course. And Blondie's, of course. How could I almost forget Blondie's? The armpit of Detroit at the time, the armpit of the punk scene, which is saying a lot. there was, you know, as a kid, I remember, you know, not as prominent as I might make him out to be in the song. Let's get that straight now. Because I was like, is that a true story? It's like, wow, sort of. You know, he's not this big legend. But now that I've written the song, all these people are like, I knew that dude. And it's just kind of loosely based on one kid that I used to see at all the shows, and this big fat kid, and he's probably only 12 or 13 when I first started seeing him. And, you know, he's really big, so you always knew that it was the peak of your set when you saw him dive, because, you know, he had to wait until the mosh pit was at maximum density, otherwise there was danger that they weren't going to catch him, you know, because he was a big fat kid. you do like one or two dives in a show, you know what I mean? So I can't remember what it was that made me remember him, you know, a year or so ago when I started jotting the lyrics down for the song. You know what? I do remember. It was a Beavis and Butthead video. I had old VHS tapes of Beavis and Butthead shows where they're watching bands and, you know, bagging on the bands or, like, making remarks. And there was a video, I think it was the Cro-Mags video, and they're like, some fat guy dives into the crowd, and he's like, there should be more fat people in videos. Fat people are cool. So that's when I said, you know, that one kid used to dive, you know, was always wearing shorts and combat boots, even in the middle of the winter. Mohawk, might have been Mexican. Got darker black hair. And, you know, and then I thought, I don't know, I guess I thought I'd write a song about it. Stage diving fat kid, never missed a show. Stage diving fat kid, I had nowhere else to go. Stage diving fat kid hated jocks and posers. Stage diving fat kid loved to mow them over.
Nice.
So, I gave him some honor, you know. I made it so that it wasn't just not funny just because he's fat, you know. It's more like he had a purpose, too. You'd see these jocks and these posers in the mosh pit and be like, screw them, and dive on them and mow them over. Because it was kind of like in the late 80s when the jocks came in and the kind of, you know, frat boy clowns would come in and, you know, had to make it into a more violent thing and, you know, kind of ruined it for, like, you know, smaller kids and stuff like that by turning it into, like, some macho contest in the mosh pit. When before there was some etiquette to a mosh pit, you know, and if people were smaller than you, you didn't take them out, you know. It wasn't a football game. It was just about having fun and getting your aggression out on the dance floor. So, I, you know, I gave the kid some honor. He had a purpose.
It sounds...
And which my wife loves. She loves the fact that she's like, oh, that's so cool. You know, he was there to take out those jocks that kept ruining it. You know, and made it so that girls couldn't go into the pit because the jocks were being too rough.
So you could almost say he's the epitome and embodies the spirit of true punk. Fat kid with a mohawk that just don't give a fuck about what people think about him.
Right.
He's going out doing his thing.
Right. Wearing shorts and combat boots in the middle of wintertime and at every show, you know, and waiting until the perfect moment, you know what I mean, until the water was just right. He'd climb up, lumber up on the stage and dive off and usually take, you know, five or six people to catch him. And still almost take him down.
Right. So did you ever catch him doing that at Harpo's?
What's funny about it is I posted those lyrics, the chorus that I just stated, on Facebook, and people from other cities, like St. Louis and Phoenix, were like, I remember that kid. They don't realize that I'm talking about a kid in Detroit. You know, there's people from other scenes and other cities. They're like, I knew that dude, you know? It's like, okay. So there's something universal about it. So, you know, that maybe there was a kid like that in a lot of scenes.
Yeah. There's a fat kid in all of us in every city around the world, you know?
Right. Well, now half of the kids are fat. But back then, you know, there was only one fat kid for every 10 or 15 of us. You know, now there's half of them are fat. Well, it's true. I mean, when I was growing up, there was, you know, there was the proverbial fat kid. There was one fat kid in your class, and it was genetic. You know, his whole family was fat, and that's just how it was. Now, I mean, last summer I saw a whole, you know, elementary school classroom walk across the crosswalk over Middle Belt Road in Livonia, and I'm like, man, two-thirds of those kids are overweight. You know, and they were like fourth and fifth graders, and they were almost all fat. Like, well, okay.
I kind of blame it on the decline.
I'm sorry to get off the subject easy, man. I got, you know, got really bad ADD.
Hey, that's all right, man. It's all good. This is good stuff, dude. Hey, I kind of blame that, the fat kid syndrome on the decline of government cheese, man. Remember those big blocks of government cheese?
Right. Well, we got some nourishment and some complex carbohydrates.
Right.
And cheese ruled, man. You know what was good? The government, when all the generic stuff started coming out, man, the generic mustard was good. The generic peanut butter in that giant, like, coffee can. That was awesome.
Hell yeah, dude. White label, black text.
Yeah, we had in this apartment building I lived in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a Vietnam vet on the bottom floor. And if we'd go to the store and, get liquor for him and stuff, he'd give us some of his government food. And that's how, we weren't going to the food bank ourselves. We had jobs, but, we didn't have good jobs and we didn't have a lot of money, so this vet would be like, go down and get me a fifth at 5 o'clock and I'll give you some of this food, And then once in a while he'd give us a handful of Tylenols too. Which that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, so tell us what you miss most about living in Detroit now that you're down in Canton.
Oh God.
Besides everything.
I miss being close to my band. I miss being able to, call either one of them up and say, let's get together and, eat at Denny's and laugh at shit or, talk about songs or, let's find a practice space, rent a storefront for a month. I miss being, closer to my band because especially right now and I've probably said this over the years a couple of times, but this, this lineup that I have right now is the best lineup. I mean, it's especially the best lineup as far as what I always envisioned and tried to get the band to sound like, and it never sounded, not even any of the records I put out, none of them sound like what I pictured it to sound like when I started. I had this idea to do this thing that's this hybrid, like, post everything rock and roll, like post blues, post jazz, post punk, post rockabilly, post garage, post metal, post prog. Because all of those things are in it, and the influences, because I grew up and started playing bass in 76, 77, so, I've gone from playing, Deep Purple songs to trying to learn Stanley Clark riffs and play fusions, or playing, Roundabout by Yes, to playing, Minor Threat and Black Flag and stuff like that, and then going into playing rockabilly. I didn't start playing upright until I was 30. And people think I've been playing upright since grade school or something. I didn't start playing upright bass until I was 30 years old. And I started doing this rockabilly thing and kind of walked into that backwards, not knowing what I was doing. And as a result of that, I'm not playing the shit right. And just ask any of the traditionalists. They'll be glad to tell you that I don't play rockabilly right. I played bass with Ronnie Dawson a few times, and he was there in the 50s. He was there, on the Alan Freed shows. He played the Grand Ole Opry back in those days, and he said there wasn't nothing wrong with how I was playing, and that all these guys work really hard to get the sound of those old rockabilly records perfect. They find that gear, and they find the strings, and they find the old Gretsch guitar and the old amp with the tweed on it and shit. And, the guys I talked to that were around in the 50s said they hated the way those records sounded. And they hated the amps that weren't loud enough, and they hated the strings that broke too easy. They're like, we couldn't wait for that gear to get better. So what everyone's striving to sound like in those traditional rockabilly bands is almost the opposite of what those guys were really doing back then. So, whatever.
Right on, man.
There's just too much dogma. Almost every scene has its dogma, Every scene has people that are like, that's not really garage rock because that guy's playing, this kind kind of guitar or something like that. I mean, that's all horseshit. You know, play what you play. I mean, not that I don't respect and appreciate a band that gets up there and does a period piece, you know, and does it just right. But it's so rare, you know. Especially here. Now, overseas, you know, over in England, there's bands over there that look and sound exactly like Bill Haley and the Comets. Like tribute acts, practically, that sound and look, dress, perform exactly like Bill Haley and the Comets, or exactly like Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps. You know, I can appreciate that. That's not my thing, so, you know, if I can appreciate that, why can't they appreciate the fact that I'm doing my own take on it, you know? I'm going to do a rockabilly thing, but I can't deny all the other influences that I picked up playing bass over the last, you know, 30 years. It doesn't make sense. I can't just pretend that, you know, I don't own Deep Purple albums. Because I do, lots of them. So all that influence goes into what we're doing, especially now with this new record. You know, I'm all done trying to please that rockabilly scene in any way, shape, or form, because I've never pleased it anyway, you know? And, you know, some of them will still buy the record. But, you know, I consider us now more of like a punk rock jump blues band. And rockabilly. If you call it rockabilly, someone always gets upset. Well, those guys aren't rockabilly. They play too loud. Well,
it's a constant evolution.
What's that?
It's a constant evolution.
It is. You know, it totally is. I mean, every step of the way, I'm not comparing myself to, you know, Jimi Hendrix or the Doors or whatever, but, you know, every one of those bands that came along, you know, there was the old guard standing there going, "Those, that guy's terrible. What do they think they're doing?" You know? I mean, but Ike Turner, you know, in the St. Louis scene started showing up and you know, playing blues with distortion, you know, with like his amp full blast. They just like, everyone was like, "This guy's crazy. He's lost his mind." But, you know, Chuck Berry was in the audience. And Chuck Berry was like, "No, he's not crazy. He's got it right. You know, kids are going to love this shit. You know, the old people don't like it, but wait till the kids get a load of this." So, yeah, I mean, it is evolution, and it should be. Art should always be evolving. You know, if it were up to people like that, you know, we'd still just be banging sticks together in a cave, you know what I mean? Progress would have stopped there, because as soon as you bang them together with some syncopation, one of those clowns would stand there going, "That's not how it goes. That's not how you do it." You know what I mean? And then their art gets stymied right there if you listen to those people. That they don't, you know, they're afraid of anything that's going to be any different. You know, it reminds me of a scene in some movie with Michael Douglas where he's like supposed to be crazy and he thinks there's buried treasure under the Home Depot down in San Fernando Valley. I think it's called King of California. And they're walking past a what's that restaurant called? Applebee's. And he goes, "You know why people eat at places like this?" And he gets all ruffled. He's like, "Because there's nothing in there that's going to surprise them." And that's just it. Some people don't want no surprises. They want predictability, perfect predictability. So, you know, sometimes we play a bar and they just sit there and look at us and they just don't know what to think. You know, we played up in Petoskey one time in northern Michigan, and they sat there and stared at us the whole night, and then we played Cold Gin by Kiss, something that they barely recognized, and something that we can barely play decently. And they all got up, the whole bar got up and danced for that one song, and then they sat back down for the rest of the night, because we didn't play anything they recognized. That's like, they have to recognize it, or they're afraid, you know what I mean? They're afraid to get up and dance.
Some people just fear change.
What's that?
Some people just fear change, kind of like in Wayne's World, right?
Yeah, they want perfect predictability in their lives. That's, I don't know. I mean, but that's fine too, you know. I mean, if it weren't for people like that, there wouldn't be, you know, AC/DC tribute bands that are doing well, and Kiss tribute bands, and Elvis impersonators, and you know what I mean, and Journey tribute bands, and even Neil Young tribute band. There's a fucking John Denver guy out there. I mean, who wants to see someone sing John Denver songs not as good as John Denver?
Right.
Not me.
Not me either, you know, man.
You know, give me a free ticket to that and watch me tear it up.
Right. Hey, Pete, man. Pete, we got to wrap this up because I got to get ready to transcribe some other stuff. But in closing, do you have anything you want to say out to everybody around the world?
Yeah, you know, I'm really not super familiar with the site and who's listening to this and who's going to hear it.
The world.
You know, I just became, through my new drummer, became aware of you, and I think I got an email from you a few days ago, so I'm going to have to find out more about it. Like I said, I kind of live in a bubble. I don't know. I've survived a lot. I've been through a lot with this band, and it's sort of like the old Hemingway novel, The Old Man and the Sea. You know, I see myself as this tragicomic character that just keeps on going, you know, and I'm going to keep this band going and get a new record done if it kills me. The third one almost killed me. I had cancer when I recorded it, but 10 years later, I'm still standing and the band's still going. This next record, if and when we get it done, which we're doing in Detroit, probably at the end of December, with Mikey Clark, who's produced, you know, Insane Clown Posse records of all things, but he has an amazing studio. When this record comes out, it's going to be my best. And part of what's taken me so long to get it done is the first three or four songs I got, you know, and I finally got them demoed on some multi-track software. I listened to it, and I ended up scratching about seven or eight songs that I thought I had because they weren't half as good as these first four. So I kind of went back to the drawing board and said, man, these first four songs are so good, better than anything I've ever written, that the rest of the record has to be this good, or it's just going to be a waste of time and money for us to record these other songs. I don't want no filler on the album, you know. So when this album, if and when it's finally done, it's going to be by far the best I've ever done.
Wow.
And I'm, you know, racking my brain to make sure. I got a song called Sit on My Ass and Do Nothing. And that's inspired by my wife because she was going out of town last spring. And she's like, what are you going to do while I'm gone? Now, I didn't say it out loud, of course. But I thought to myself, sit on my ass and do nothing. And then as soon as I thought that, I'm like, there's a song in that. You know, especially for us middle-aged dudes that are like, the weekend comes along and my plan is make no plans. My plan, since I don't have a gig or anything to do, is to just do nothing. And I can't wait, and I'm so excited. So that's kind of what the song is about. I'm so excited about the weekend because I'm going to sit on my ass and do nothing.
Yeah, that sounds like that could become a national anthem for us middle-aged crisis people.
Right. Like, yeah. What are you going to do this weekend? Nothing. Put some fresh batteries in the remote, you know, get the Beverly Hillbillies box set, Three Stooges box set out, ready to go, and that's it. Ain't taking no calls. No, it goes, one of the lines is, ain't taking no texts, no emails, ain't taking no calls. I'm going to be lying on the couch, scratching my balls.
Fucking great, man. I love it.
Take that, Yeats. Take that, Emily Dickinson. That's poetry.
All right, Pistol Pete, Twisting Tarantulas, we're good to see you guys this weekend. We got you, you're going to be in Toledo tomorrow night. And then we got you at the Tip Top Deluxe in Grand Rapids on Friday, Black Friday. Then we have you on Saturday over here in the Metro Detroit area at the Rock in Plymouth. Then the week of Christmas, week before Christmas, you're going to be playing Bell's Brewery in Kalamazoo, one of the
Bell's
best Michigan craft breweries.
Bell's Brewery, our triumphant return to Kalamazoo after quite a few years.
Oh, yeah, man, that place rocks.
And New Year's Eve at Hop Cat, which is a brand new club in downtown Detroit, on Woodward Avenue, just up the street from the Majestic and the Magic Station.
That's going to be packed, too. And you guys are going to be in Keego Harbor at Bachelor One, about 5 minutes from my house. 5 minutes from my house on December 26th and 27th. So I will definitely see you guys there, man.
Good old Bachelor's One, a two-nighter where we get to set up our gear and then play Friday night and walk out of there without having to tear all that shit down.
Hallelujah, man.
They got some good food in there, too.
No, I never stepped foot in there, man. Cool. So, all right, Pete.
Hey, thanks for all the plugs, man. And thanks for, the interest in rock and roll and talking to me and giving me this opportunity. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure, man. You guys are legends around here. We want to keep that legacy alive.
So do I.
All right, Pete.
Because if you don't see us playing anywhere, chances are I'm dead. So I want to make sure to keep seeing Twisting Tarantulas gigs on the calendar, because the only alternative is, 6 feet under for me.
And you sure as hell don't want to be sitting on your ass doing nothing but scratching your balls.
That could be maybe another possibility. I could be just doing that weekend.
Wow. All right, Pete. But thanks a lot for your time, brother.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.